I acquire much of my new French vocabulary, not just from Bean, but from the many French kids' books we somehow end up owning, thanks to birthday parties, impulse purchases, and neighbors' garage sales. I'm careful not to read to Bean in French if there's a native speaker within earshot. I can hear my American accent and the way I stumble over the odd word. Usually, I'm trying so hard not to mispronounce anything too egregiously that I grasp the storyline only on the third reading. I soon notice that French and English kids' books and songs aren't just in different languages. Often they have very different storylines and moral messages. In the American books, there's usually a problem, a struggle to fix the problem, and then a cheerful resolution. The spoon wishes that she were a fork, or a knife, but eventually realizes how great it is to be a spoon. The boy who wouldn't let the other kids play in his box is then excluded from the box himself, and realizes that all the kids should play in the box together. Lessons are learned, and life gets better. It's not just the books. I notice how deliriously hopeful I sound when I sing to Bean about how if you're happy and you know it, clap your hands, and when you're watching a DVD of the musical Annie, how the sun'll come out tomorrow. In the English-speaking world, every problem seems to have a solution, and prosperity is just around the corner. The French books I read to Bean start out with a similar structure. There's a problem, and the characters struggle to overcome that problem, but they seldom succeed for very long. Often the book ends with the protagonist having the same problem again. There is rarely a moment of personal transformation when everyone learns and grows. One of Bean's favorite French books is about two pretty little girls who are cousins and best friends. Aliette, the redhead, is always bossing around Alice, the brunette. One day, Alice decides she can't take it anymore and stops playing with Aliette. There's a long, lonely standoff. Finally, Aliette comes to Alice's house, begging her pardon and promising to change. Alice accepts the apology. A page later, the girls are playing doctor and Aliette is trying to jab Alice with a syringe. Nothing has changed. The end. Not all French kids' books end this way, but a lot of them do. The message is that endings don't have to be tidy to be happy. It's a cliché about Europeans, but you can see it in the morals of Bean's French stories. Life is ambiguous and complicated. There aren't bad guys and good guys. Each of us has a bit of both. Aliette is bossy, but she's also lots of fun. Alice is the victim, but she also seems to ask for it, and she goes back for more. We're to presume that Aliette and Alice keep up their little dysfunctional cycle because, well, that's what a friendship between two girls is like. I wish I had known that when I was 4, instead of finally figuring it out in my 30s. Writer Deborah Olivier points out that American girls pick the petals off daisies saying, "He loves me, he loves me not." Whereas little French girls allow for more subtle varieties of affection, saying, "He loves me a little, a lot, passionately, madly, not at all." Characters in French kids' books can have contradictory qualities. In one of Bean's perfect princess books, Zoé opens a present and declares that she doesn't like it. But on the next page, Zoé is a perfect princess who jumps up and says merci to the gift giver. If there were an American version of this book, Zoé would probably overcome her bad habits and morph fully into the perfect princess. The French book is more like real life. Zoé continues to struggle with both sides of her personality. The book tries to encourage princess-like habits. There's a little certificate at the end for good behavior, but takes for granted that kids also have a built-in impulse to do bêtises. There's also a lot of nudity and love in French books for 4-year-olds. Bean has a book about a boy who accidentally goes to school naked. She has another about a romance between the boy who accidentally pees in his pants and the little girl who lends him her pants while fashioning her bandana into a skirt. These books, and the French parents I know, treat the crushes and romances of preschoolers as genuine. I get to know a few people who grew up in France with American parents. When I ask whether they feel French or American, they almost all say that it depends on the context. They feel American when they're in France, and French when they're in America. Bean seems headed for something similar. I'm able to transmit some American traits, like whining and sleeping badly, with little effort, but others require a lot of work. I begin picking up certain American holidays, based mainly on the amount of cooking each one requires. Halloween is a keeper. Thanksgiving is out. 4th of July is close enough to Bastille Day, July 14th, that I sort of feel like we're celebrating both. I'm not sure what constitutes classically American food, but I'm strangely adamant that Bean should like tuna melts. Making Bean feel a bit American is hard enough. On top of that, I'd also like her to feel Jewish. Though I put her on the no pork list at school, this apparently isn't enough to cement her religious identity. She keeps trying to get a grip on what this strange anti-Santa label means and how she can get out of it.
"I don't want to be Jewish. I want to be British," she announces in early December.
I'm reluctant to mention God. I fear that telling her there's an omnipotent being everywhere, including presumably in her room, would terrify her. She's already afraid of witches and wolves. Instead, in the spring, I prepare an elegant Passover dinner. Halfway through the first benediction, Bean begs to leave the table. Simon sits at the far end with a sullen, "I told you so," look. We slurp our matzo ball soup, then turn on some Dutch football. Hanukkah is a big success. The fact that Bean is 6 months older probably helps. So do the candles and the presents. What really wins Bean over is that we sing and dance the Hora in our living room, then collapse in a dizzy circle. But after 8 nights of this and 8 carefully selected presents, she's still skeptical.
"Hanukkah is over. We're not Jewish anymore," she tells me.
She wants to know whether Father Christmas, a.k.a. the Père Noël she's been hearing about in school, will be coming to our house. On Christmas Eve, Simon insists on setting out shoes with presents in front of our fireplace. He claims he's loosely following the Dutch cultural tradition, not the religious one. The Dutch put out shoes on December 5th. Bean is ecstatic when she wakes up and sees the shoes, even though the only thing in them is a cheap yo-yo and some plastic scissors.
"Père Noël doesn't usually visit the Jewish children, but he came to our house this year," she chirps.
After that, when I pick her up at school, our conversations usually go something like this. Me: "What did you do at school today?" Bean:
"I ate pork."
As long as we're foreign, it's not a bad idea to be native English speakers. English is, of course, the language du jour in France. Most Parisians under 40 can speak it at least passably. Bean's teacher asks me and a Canadian dad to come in one morning to read some English language books out loud to the kids in Bean's class. Several of Bean's friends take English lessons. The parents coo about how lucky Bean is to be bilingual. But there's a downside to having foreign parents. Simon always reminds me that, as a child in Holland, he cringed when his parents spoke Dutch in public. I'm reminded of that when, at the year-end concert at Bean's preschool, parents are invited to join in for a few songs. Most of the other parents know the words. I mumble along, hoping that Bean doesn't notice. It's clear that I will have to compromise between the American identity I'd like to give Bean and the French one she is quickly absorbing. I get used to her calling Cinderella, Cendrillon, and Snow White, Blanche-Neige. I laugh when she tells me that a boy in her class likes Spider-Man, complete with a guttural R, instead of Spider-Man. But I draw the line when she claims that the 7 dwarfs sing Hey Ho, as they do in the French voiceover. Some things are sacred. Luckily, it turns out that bits of Anglophone culture are irresistibly catchy. As I'm walking Bean to school one morning, through the glorious medieval streets of our neighborhood, she suddenly starts singing The Sun'll Come Out Tomorrow. We sing it together all the way to school. My hopeful little American girl is still in there. I finally decide to ask some French adults about this mysterious word, caca bouda. They're tickled that I'm taking caca bouda so seriously. It turns out that it is a swear word, but one that's just for little kids. They pick it up from each other around the time when they start learning to use the toilet. Saying caca bouda is a little bit of a bêtise, but parents understand that that's the joy of it. It's a way for kids to thumb their noses at the world and to transgress. The adults I speak to recognize that since children have so many rules and limits, they need some freedom too. Kakapuda gives kids power and autonomy. Bean's former teacher, Anne-Marie, smiles indulgently when I ask her about Kakapuda.
It's part of the environment, she explains. We said it when we were little too.
That doesn't mean that children can say Kakapuda whenever they want. The parenting guide, Votre Enfant, suggests telling kids they can only say bad words when they're in the bathroom. Some parents tell me they ban such words from the dinner table. They don't forbid kids from saying Kakapuda. They teach them to wield it appropriately. When Bean and I visit a French family in Brittany, she and their little girl, Léonie, stick out their tongues at the little girl's grandmother. The grandmother immediately sits them down for a talk about when it's appropriate to do such things.
When you're alone in your room, you can. When you're alone in the bathroom, you can. You can go barefoot, stick out your tongue, point at someone, say, Kaka, Buddha. You can do all that when you're by yourself. But when you're at school, no. When you're at the table, no. When you're with mommy and daddy, no. In the street, no. Celebi, you must understand the difference.
Once Simon and I learn more about Kaka, Buddha, we decide to lift our moratorium on it. We tell Bean that she can say it, but not too much. We like the philosophy behind it, and even occasionally say it ourselves. A curse word just for kids. How quaint. How French. In the end, I think the social complexities of Kakapuda are too subtle for us to master. When the father of one of Bean's school friends comes to fetch his daughter at our house one Sunday afternoon after play date, he hears Bean shouting, Kakapuda, as she runs down the hall. The father, a banker, looks at me warily. I'm sure he mentions the incident to his wife. His daughter hasn't been back to our house since. Chapter 10. Double Entendre. So, I finished my book, and for about 15 glorious minutes before breakfast one morning, I'm within 100 grams of my target weight. I'm all ready to be pregnant. And yet, I'm not. Everyone around me is. There seems to be a last gasp of fertility among my friends who are, like me, in their late 30s. Getting pregnant with Bean was a bit like having a pizza delivered. You want one? Phone up and get one. It worked on the first try. But this time, there's no pizza. As the months go by, I feel the age gap between Bean and her theoretical, possibly counterfactual sibling widening. I don't feel like I have many months to spare. If I don't have the second baby soon, the third will become physically impossible. My doctor tells me that my cycle has become too long. She says the egg shouldn't be sitting on the shelf so long before it breaks through to reach a possible mate. She prescribes Clomid, which makes me release more eggs, upping the odds that one will stay fit enough. Meanwhile, more friends call me with their wonderful news. They're pregnant. I'm happy for them. Really, I am. After about 8 months, I get the name of an acupuncturist specializing in fertility. She has long black hair and a storefront in a low-end Parisian business district. Most cities have one Chinatown. Paris has 5 or 6. The acupuncturist studies my tongue, sticks some needles in my arms, and asks the length of my cycle.
That's too long, she says, explaining that the egg is withering on the shelf.
She writes me a prescription for a liquid potion that tastes like tree bark. I drink it dutifully. I don't get pregnant. Simon says he'd be happy with just one kid. Out of respect for him, I consider this possibility for about 4 seconds. Something primal is driving me. It doesn't feel Darwinian. It feels like a carbohydrate high. I want more pizza. I go back to my doctor and tell her I'm ready to up the ante. What else has she got? She doesn't think we need to go all the way to in vitro fertilization. France's national insurance pays for up to 6 rounds of IVF for women under age 43. Instead, she teaches me to inject myself in the thigh with a drug that will force me to ovulate earlier in my cycle, so the egg won't have time to wither. For this to work, I have to take the shot on day 14, and in a primitive twist, just after taking the shot, I must have sex. It turns out that at the next 14-day point, Simon will be in Amsterdam for work. For me, there's no question of waiting another month. I book a babysitter for Bean and arrange to meet Simon in Brussels, which is about halfway between Amsterdam and Paris. We plan to have a leisurely dinner and then retire to our hotel room. At the very least, it'll be a nice escape. He'll return to Amsterdam the next morning. On day 14, there's a massive storm and a freak rail service breakdown in Western Holland. Just as I arrive at the Brussels train station around 6 p.m., Simon calls to say that his train has been halted in Rotterdam. It's unclear which trains, if any, will leave from there. He might not get to Brussels tonight. He'll call me back. As if on cue, it starts to rain. I've carried the injection in a portable cooler with a cold pack that lasts only a few hours. What if I get caught in a hot train? I dash into a convenience store at the station, buy a bag of frozen peas, and shove them inside the cooler. Simon calls back to say there's a train leaving Rotterdam for Antwerp. Can I meet him in Antwerp? On the giant overhead screen, I see that there's a train leaving Brussels for Antwerp in a few minutes. In a scene where the Bourne identity meets Sex and the City, I grab my P-wrap syringe and bolt up to the platform. I'm in the rain, about to board the train to Antwerp, when Simon calls again. "Don't get on!" he shouts. He's on a train bound for Brussels. I take a taxi to our hotel, which is cozy and warm, and decked out for Christmas with a giant tree. I should be grateful just to be there, but the first room the bellhop brings me to doesn't quite have the conception vibe I'm looking for. He leads me to another room on the top floor with a slanted ceiling. This one seems like a good place to procreate. While I wait for Simon to arrive, I take a bath, put on a robe, then calmly jab myself with a syringe. I realize I wouldn't make a bad junkie. I hope, however, that I'll make an even better mother of two. A few weeks later, I'm in London for work. I buy a pregnancy test at a pharmacy, then I buy a bagel at a deli, for the sole purpose of using its dingy basement bathroom to take the test. Okay, I also eat the bagel. To my amazement, the test is positive. I call Simon while I'm pulling my suitcase to a meeting. He immediately starts choosing nicknames. Since the baby was conceived in Brussels, maybe we'll call him Sprout. Simon comes with me to an ultrasound a month later. I lie back on the table watching the screen. The baby looks wonderful, heartbeat, head, legs. Then I notice a dark spot off to the side. "What's that?" I ask the doctor. She moves the wand over a bit. Suddenly, another little body pops onto the screen with its own heartbeat, head, and legs. "Twins," she says. This is one of the best moments of my life. I feel like I've been given an enormous gift. Two pizzas. It also seems like a very efficient way for a woman in her late 30s to breed. When I turn to look at Simon, I realize that the best moment of my life may be the worst moment of his. He appears to be in shock. For once, I don't want to know what he's thinking. I'm giddy from the idea of twins. He's blown over by the enormity of it. "I'll never be able to go to a cafe again," he says. Already he foresees the end of his free time. "You could get one of those home espresso makers," the doctor suggests. My French friends and neighbors congratulate us on the news. They treat the reason of having twins as none of their business. The Anglophones I know are generally less discreet. "Were you surprised?" a mother in my playgroup asks when I announce the news. When I offer an unrevealing yes, she tries again. "Well, was your doctor surprised?" I'm too busy to be bothered. Simon and I have decided that what we really need isn't a better coffee maker. It's a larger apartment. Our current one has just two small bedrooms. This seems even more urgent when we discover that the babies are both boys. I trek out to see several dozen apartments, all of which are either too dark, too expensive, or have long, scary hallways leading to tiny kitchens. Apparently in the 19th century, it wasn't chic to smell food while the servants were cooking it. The real estate agents always boast that the place I'm about to see is very calm. This seems to be a prized quality in both French apartments and French children. All the focus on real estate keeps me from worrying too much about the pregnancy. I think I've also absorbed the French idea that there's no need to track the formation of each fetal eyebrow, though there are quite a few eyebrows in there to worry about. I do briefly indulge in some twin-specific angst, like about the babies being born prematurely, but mostly the health system does the worrying for me. Because it's twins, I get extra doctor's visits and sonograms. At each visit, the handsome radiologist points out baby A and baby B on the screen, then makes the same bad joke. You're not obliged to keep those names. I flash him my best micro-smile. This time around, it's Simon who's anxious about himself, not the babies. He treats each cheese plate as if it's his last. I revel in all the attention. Despite the free IVF, twins are still a novelty in Paris. I'm told that doctors often implant just one or two embryos. Within a few weeks, I'm visibly pregnant. By 6 months, it looks like I'm about to deliver. Even some maternity clothes are too tight. Soon it's clear, even to young children, that there's more than one baby in there. I also study up on the nomenclature. In French, twins aren't called identical or fraternal. They're called vrai or faux, real or fake. I get used to telling people that I'm waiting for two fake twin boys. I needn't have worried about my fake boys coming out early. At 9 months pregnant, I have two full-sized babies inside of me, each weighing nearly as much as Bean did. People point at me from cafe tables, and I can no longer climb stairs. If you want an apartment, go find one, I tell Simon. Less than a week later, after seeing exactly one apartment, he does. The apartment is old, even for Paris. It has no hallways and a triple-wide sidewalk in front. It needs a lot of work. We buy it. The day before I give birth, I meet with an architect to plan the renovations. The private hospital where I delivered Bean was small and spotless, with an around-the-clock nursery, endless fresh towels, and steak and foie gras on the room service menu. I barely had to change a diaper. I've been warned that the public maternity hospital where I'm planning to deliver the twins will be a less rarefied experience. The medicine is excellent at French public hospitals, but the service is supposedly no frills. They give you a list of things to bring to the birth, which includes diapers. There's no customizing with birth plans, bathtubs, and walking epidurals. They don't give the baby a chic little hat. People keep saying conveyor belt to describe the efficient but impersonal experience. I opt for Hôpital Armand Trousseau because it's a 10-minute taxi ride from our house, and it's equipped to handle complications with twins. I later learned that it's attached to the children's hospital where Françoise Dautot did her weekly rounds. I don't want to give birth in a bathtub anyway, and I figure that when the moment comes, I'll just use my New York chutzpah to customize things. I point out to Simon that we're already enjoying economies of scale. They're going to deliver our two babies for the price of one. When I go into labor, the epidural isn't optional. The doctor puts me in a sterile operating room so he can do a C-section instantly if necessary. I'm flat on my back, my legs locked into a retro 1950s harness, surrounded by strangers in shower caps and surgical masks. I ask several times for someone to put pillows under my back so I can see what's happening. No one even responds. Eventually, in a small concession, someone shoves a folded sheet under me, which just makes me more uncomfortable. As soon as active delivery starts, my French evaporates. I can't understand anything the doctor says, and I can only speak English. This must have happened before, because a midwife immediately begins interpreting between me and the doctor. Maybe she's summarizing, or maybe her English isn't great, but she mostly just says push and don't push. When the first baby emerges, the midwife hands him to me. I'm captivated. Here is baby A at last. We're just getting acquainted when the midwife taps me on the shoulder. Excuse me, but you must deliver the other baby, she says, taking baby A to an undisclosed location. I realize right then that having twins is going to be complicated. 9 minutes later, baby B emerges. I say a quick hello and then they whisk him away too. In fact, soon almost everyone is gone, Simon, the babies, and most of the enormous medical team. I'm still on my back, paralyzed from the waist down. My legs are up in the harness, spread wide apart. On a stainless steel table in front of me are two red placentas, each the size of a human head. Someone has decided to open the dividing curtains that were the walls of my room, so now anyone who walks past has a bull's-eye view of my 5 minutes post-twins crotch. The only person still with me is the anesthesia nurse, who also isn't thrilled about being left behind. She decides to mask her irritation by making small talk. Where am I from? Do I like Paris? Where are my babies? When can I see them? I ask. My French has reappeared. She doesn't know, and she's not allowed to leave me to find out. 20 minutes pass. No one comes for us. Perhaps because of the hormones, none of this bothers me, though I'm grateful when the nurse finally uses surgical tape to put up a little modesty cloth between my knees. After that, she no longer wants to chat. I hate my job, she says. Eventually, someone wheels me into a recovery room where I reunite with Simon and the babies. We take pictures, and for the first and only time, I attempt to nurse both boys at once. An orderly wheels us to the room where the boys and I will be staying for the next few days. A boutique hotel, it's not. It's more like a Motel 6. There's a skeletal staff to help out, and a nursery that's open from about 1 to 4 a.m. Because I have an older child and am thus deemed unable to mess up too badly, the staff leaves me practically on my own. At mealtimes, someone brings in plastic trays with a parody of hospital food, limp French fries, chicken nuggets, and chocolate milk. It takes me a few days to realize that none of the other mothers are eating this. There's a communal refrigerator down the hall, where they store groceries. Simon is home looking after Bean, so most of the time I'm alone with the boys, who howl for hours at a stretch. I usually wedge one between my legs, in some approximation of a hug, while I try to nurse the other. With the constant blur of noise and body parts, it feels like there are more than two of them. When I finally get them both to sleep after hours of wailing and drinking, Simon shows up. It's so peaceful in here, he says. I try not to think about the fact that my belly looks like a giant mound of flesh-colored jello. Amid all this, we have to name the boys. The city of Paris gives you 3 days. By day two, an angry bureaucrat marches into your hospital room holding a clipboard. Simon asks only that Nelson is somewhere in the mix, after his hero, Nelson Mandela. Mostly he's worried about selecting the perfect nicknames. He wants to call one boy Gonzo and the other Chairman. I have a thing for contiguous vowels, and I'm considering calling them both Raoul. We settle on Joel, whom we'll only ever call Joey, and Leo, who defies all attempts at nicknames. They're the most fraternal twins I've ever seen. Joey looks like me, except with platinum blonde hair. Leo is a swarthy little Mediterranean man. If they weren't exactly the same size and constantly together, you wouldn't guess that they were related. I'll later find that a good tip-off that someone has no interest in babies is if they ask whether the boys are identical. After 4 long days, we're allowed to leave the hospital. Being at home with the boys is only marginally easier. In the early evenings, they wail for hours. Both wake up all through the night. Simon and I each pick a baby before we go to sleep and are responsible for that one the whole night. We each angle to pick the better baby, but who that is keeps changing. Anyway, we haven't yet moved into the larger apartment, so we're all sleeping in the same room. When one baby wakes up, everyone else does too. It still feels like there are more than two of them. I never thought I'd dress twins alike, but I'm suddenly tempted to do so just to create a little bit of order, at least visually, like making kids at a tough school wear uniforms. Amazingly, I still find time to be neurotic. I'm obsessed with the idea that we've given the boys the wrong names, and that I should go back to the town hall and switch them. I spend my few leisure minutes ruminating on this. Then comes the small matter of the circumcisions. Most French babies aren't circumcised. Mostly just Jews and Muslims do this. Because it's August in Paris, even the Moyles, who do ritual circumcisions, are on vacation. We wait for one who's been recommended, a man who is reassuringly both a Moyle and a pediatrician, to come back. Unlike the birth, the circumcision isn't two for the price of one. There isn't even a package discount. Before the little ceremony, I confess to the Moyle that I fear I've given the boys the wrong names and that I may need to switch them. He doesn't offer me any spiritual advice, but being French, he explains that the bureaucracy I'd need to go through to do this would be labyrinthine and excruciating. Somehow this information, plus the consecration of the circumcisions, erases my doubt. After the ceremony, I never worry about their names again. Thankfully, my mother has arrived from Miami. She, Simon, and I spend most of our time in the living room holding the boys. One day a woman rings the doorbell. She explains that she's a psychologist from the PMI office in our neighborhood. She says that she pays house calls to all mothers of twins, which I think is a tactful way of saying that she wants to make sure I'm not having a breakdown. A few days later, a midwife from the same PMI stops by and stands with me as I'm changing Joey's diaper. His poop, she declares, is excellent. I take that to be the official view of the French state. We're able to put some of what we've learned about French parenting to use on the boys. We slowly nudge them onto the national meal plan, with four feeds a day. From the time they're a few months old, except for the goûter, they never snack. Unfortunately, we don't get to try out the paws on them. Having newborn twins who don't even have a room of their own, and an older child who's just a few feet away, makes it difficult to try out anything. So, once again, we suffer. After about a month of almost no sleep, Simon and I are zombies. We fall back on our Filipina nanny and her network of cousins and friends. We eventually have four different women to help us, on shifts covering practically 24 hours a day. We're bleeding cash, but at least we're sleeping a bit. I start to view mothers of multiples as a persecuted minority, like Tibetans. Both boys have trouble breastfeeding, so I spend a lot of time upstairs in my bedroom, bonding with my electric breast pump. Bean eventually figures out that she can spend time alone with me if she sits with me while I pump. She learns to assemble the bottles and receptacles as if she's putting together a rifle. She does a great impression of the wappa wappa sound the pump makes. Most of the time, I look like a stunned animal. I come downstairs to deliver my bottles of milk or send Bean down with them and go back to sleep. There are so many babysitters around that I feel more like a supporting cast member than a lead actress. I'm convinced the boys don't know that among all these women, I'm their mother. I must seem detached, because at one point, a friend grabs me by the shoulders, stares me in the eye, and asks whether I'm okay. This isn't easy for her. She's quite a bit shorter than me. "I'm okay, but I'm running out of money," I say. I spend so much time singing Silent Night to the boys, more as a command than a lullaby, that one of the babysitters asks me if I become a Catholic. Meanwhile, our renovations are underway. Between pumping sessions, I dash over to inspect the new apartment. I meet with the head of the building association, an economist in his 60s, to discuss whether we can leave our double stroller in the vestibule downstairs. He won't commit.
"The previous owners were excellent neighbors," he says.
"Excellent how?" I ask.
"They were very discreet," he says.
The apartment itself is an enormous mess. I had approved the plans one night, while the boys were having a full-on fit of colic. It's suddenly clear that I had no idea how to read them. 200-year-old doors and walls, which I had thought were fine, have been thrown away. They've been replaced with new, flimsy ones. It's only when the renovations are done and we move in that I realize I've turned our 19th-century Parisian apartment into what looks like a high-rise condominium in Miami, but with mice. I didn't understand quite how beautiful Paris is, the heavy doors, the intricate moldings, until I destroyed a small part of it, at enormous expense. Now I spend a lot of time ruminating on this. You know how Edith Piaf said, Je ne regrette rien. I regret nothing, I ask Simon. Well, for me, it's je regrette tout. I regret everything. Occasionally, our life shifts from expensive and exhausting to merely surreal. When the boys are a bit older, a single girlfriend of mine stops by before bedtime one night. She watches as the boys, in footed pajamas, silently pull themselves up and down the furniture in a kind of Dadaist dance. Later, they'll march around silently while holding their toothbrushes aloft, like talismans. Simon watches them and pretends to narrate a documentary. To these boys, in their culture, toothbrushes are these curious status symbols, he explains. Mostly, our new life is full of extreme emotions. Simon mopes around in exhaustion and despair, taking little passive-aggressive snips at me. Maybe in 18 years I'll get to have a cup of coffee, he says. He describes the dread he feels when he approaches our house and hears the wailing from outside. Three kids under the age of three are a lot, even among our very fertile cohort. Amid all the crying and complaining, there are hopeful moments. My whole mood lifts one afternoon when Leo is cheerful and calm for 5 whole minutes. The first night that he sleeps 7 straight hours, Simon jumps around the house singing the Frank Zappa song, Titties and Beer. Even so, I still feel much as I did at the moment of the boy's birth, that my attention is hopelessly divided. I ask my friend Hélène, who also has twins and a singleton, whether she's considering having more. I don't think so. I am at the limit of my competence, she says. I know exactly what she means. Only I fear that I've surpassed my competence. Even my mother, who spent years begging for grandchildren, tells me not to have any more kids. As if to cement my status, Bean comes home from school one day and announces that I'm a maman crotte de nez. I immediately type this into Google Translate. It turns out that she has called me a mommy booger. Given the circumstances, it's a very good description. Chapter 11. I adore this baguette. Friends tell me that parents of twins have a high divorce rate. I'm not sure this is statistically true, but I can certainly understand how the rumor got started. In the months after the twins are born, Simon and I bicker constantly. During one argument, he tells me that I'm rebarbative. I have to look up this word, too. The dictionary says, unattractive and objectionable, a rebarbative modern building. I march back to Simon. Unattractive? I ask. Even in our current state, that's a low blow. Okay, you're just objectionable, he says. To remind myself to be civil, I tape up signs around the apartment that read, Don't snap at Simon. There's one on the bathroom mirror in plain view of the babysitters. Simon and I are too tired to realize that we're fighting because we're tired. I no longer care what he's thinking about, though it's probably still Dutch football. During rare moments of leisure, Simon likes to burrow in bed with a magazine. If I dare to interrupt him, he says, There's nothing you can say to me that's more interesting than this article I'm reading in the New Yorker. One day I have a revelation. I think we're actually quite compatible, I tell him. You're irritable, and I'm irritating. Apparently, we send off a scary vibe. A childless couple we know comes to visit from Chicago and concludes, after 4 days, that they don't want kids after all. At the end of one weekend, en famille, Bean decides that she doesn't want to have kids either. Children are too difficult, she says. On a positive note for our relationship, we get spots in the creche for both boys. Even my mother is relieved to hear this. Twins are still uncommon enough in France that our application got priority status. The creche committee took such pity on us that they assigned the boys to a tiny creche 2 blocks from our new home, which I'd been told had no vacancies. The creche offers some hope for the future, but we still have to survive as a family and, perhaps more dauntingly, as a couple until we hand the boys over in a few months. We've decided to keep them at home until they're a year old. It's not always obvious that Simon and I will make it that long. It seems no coincidence that as concerted cultivation has become the de facto parenting style for the American middle class, research shows that marital satisfaction has fallen, and that mothers find it more pleasant to do housework than to take care of their kids. American social scientists now pretty much take for granted that today's parents are less happy than non-parents. Studies show that parents have higher rates of depression and that their unhappiness increases with each additional child, or in Simon's case, with merely seeing those additional children on an ultrasound. Maybe we just need a date night. While I've been living in France, date nights have become the new penicillin for North American couples with kids. Hate your spouse? Have a date night. Want to strangle your kids? Go out to dinner. The Obamas go on date nights. Even social scientists now study them. A paper on middle-class Canadians found that when couples got leisure time alone together, it helped them tremendously as a couple, rejuvenated them personally, and re-inspired their parenting. But the couples in the study rarely got this time. Many participants felt pressured by the wider culture to always place the needs of the children above the needs of the partnership, the authors conclude. One husband said that while speaking to his wife, we would be interrupted on a minute-to-minute basis by the children. This is, of course, another consequence of concerted cultivation, which eats up leisure time and makes fomenting the child's development the family's overwhelming priority. I see this all around me when I visit the United States and the United Kingdom. An American cousin of mine, who's a nurse with four kids, has family nearby who'd be willing to babysit, but after a week of getting everybody to school, gymnastics, track meets, and church, she and her husband, who works nights as a policeman, don't even consider going out alone. They're too tired. A school teacher from Manchester, England, tells me that she's taking her toddler on her honeymoon, even though her mother has volunteered to watch him. "I just feel too bad leaving him behind," she explains. Every Anglophone mother I speak to has a cautionary tale about a mother in her social circle who refuses to leave her child with anyone. These moms aren't urban myths. I frequently meet them. At a wedding, I sit next to a stay-at-home mother from Colorado who explains that she has a full-time babysitter but never leaves a sitter alone with her three kids. Her husband has skipped the wedding to look after them. An artist from Michigan tells me that she couldn't bring herself to use a babysitter for her son's whole first year. "He seems so tiny. He was my first kid. I'm really pretty neurotic. The idea of handing him over to someone?" Some American parents I meet have adopted such specific diets and discipline techniques that it's hard for anyone else, even a grandparent, to take over and follow all the rules. A grandfather from Virginia says his daughter became livid when he pushed her baby's stroller the wrong way over a bump. The baby's mom had read that there's a smaller chance of brain damage if babies go over bumps backward. Obviously, Simon and I aren't against babysitters. We're currently employing half the Philippines. But since the boys were born, I haven't spent more than a few hours away from home. Mostly, I do what that mother from Colorado does. I use the babysitter as a kind of assistant who changes diapers and does the laundry, but I'm usually on the premises. This system has the advantage of both depleting our savings and destroying our relationship simultaneously. I feel rebarbative much of the time. I realize I'm losing my mind a little bit when, about 15 minutes before one of our babysitters is supposed to arrive, my phone beeps, indicating that I have a new text message. I panic, fearing that the babysitter is late. In fact, it's a message from a news service that I subscribe to, informing me that there's been a deadly earthquake in South America. For an instant, I'm relieved. Of course, it's easier to get along with your spouse if your baby sleeps through the night by 3 months old, your kids play by themselves, and you're not constantly shuttling them from one activity to the next. It also helps that couples in France don't have some of the big financial stressors, like high costs for childcare, healthcare, and college. In the short term, however, what seems to really help is that French couples view romance differently, even when they have young kids. I get an inkling of this when my gynecologist writes me a prescription for 10 sessions of rééducation périnéale. Perineal re-education. She did this for the first time after Bean was born, and again after the birth of the boys. Before my first re-education, I had only been vaguely aware that I had a perineum, or what exactly it is. It turns out to be the hammock-like pelvic floor area, which often gets stretched out during pregnancy and birth. The stretching loosens the birth canal and can cause mothers to pee a little bit whenever they cough or sneeze. In the United States, doctors sometimes suggest that women tone their perineums with Kegel squeezes. But often they don't suggest anything. Being a little slack and leaky is just a seldom-mentioned part of being an American mom. In France, such troubles are pas acceptable. Friends tell me that their French obstetricians gauge whether a few sessions of perineal re-education are needed by asking, "Is Monsieur happy?" I think my monsieur would be happy to have any access to my perineum. The region hasn't exactly lain fallow in the year or so since the boys were born, but I wouldn't say there's any danger of overuse. For a while, as soon as Simon went anywhere near my breasts, it was like a fire alarm. They began spurting milk. Anyway, sleep is more of a priority for us. Though all three kids now technically do their nights, somehow, I never seem to sleep more than 6 or 7 straight hours. I'm intrigued enough by the perineal re-education to give it a try. My first re-educator is a slim Spanish woman named Monica, with an office in the Marais neighborhood. Our introductory session begins with a 45-minute interview, during which she asks me dozens of questions about my bathroom habits and my sex life. Then I disrobe from the waist down and lie on a padded table covered with crinkly paper. Monica slips on surgical gloves and leads me in what I can best describe as assisted crunches for the crotch, in sets of 15, and up and release. It's a bit like Pilates for the below-the-belt region. Afterward, Monica shows me a slender white wand that she'll introduce in the next phase. It resembles a device you might see for sale in an adults-only shop. The wand will add electrostimulation to my mini-sit-ups. By the 10th session, we'll be ready to try out a kind of video game in which sensors on my groin measure whether I'm contracting the muscles enough to stay above a running orange line on the computer screen. Perineal re-education is at once extremely intimate and strangely clinical. Throughout the exercises, Monica and I address each other using the formal vous, but she asks me to close my eyes so I can better isolate the muscles where her hand is. My doctor writes me a prescription for abdominal re-education, too. She's noticed that, more than a year after the twins are born, I still have a kind of bulge around my waist that's part fat, part stretch, and part unknown substance. Frankly, I'm not sure what's in there. I decide that it's time to take action when I'm standing up on the Paris metro and a decrepit old woman offers me her seat. She thinks I'm pregnant. Not all French women do re-education after they give birth, but many do. Why not? France's national insurance picks up most or all of the cost, including the price of the white wand. The state even helps pay for some tummy tucks, usually when the mother's belly hangs below her pubis, or when it's inhibiting her sex life. Of course, all this re-education just gets mothers out of the starting gate. What do French women do once their bellies and their pelvic floors are back in fighting shape? Some do focus only on their kids, but unlike in the United States or Britain, the culture doesn't encourage or reward this. Sacrificing your sex life for your kids is considered wildly unhealthy and out of balance. The French know that having a baby changes things, especially at first. Couples typically assume that there's a very intense stretch after the birth, when it's all hands on deck for the baby. After that, gradually, the mother and father are supposed to find their equilibrium as a couple again. There's this fundamental assumption in France that every human being has desire. It never disappears for very long. If it does, it means you're depressed and you need to be treated, explains Marie-Anne Suizot, the University of Texas sociologist who studied French and American mothers. The French mothers I meet talk about le couple, in a whole different way from the American parents I know. For me, the couple comes before the children, says Virginie, the stay-at-home mom who taught me to pay attention to what I eat. Virginie is principled, smart, and a devoted mother. She's the only young Parisian I know who's an observant Catholic, but she has no intention of letting her romantic life slacken just because she has three kids.
The couple is the most important, is the only thing that you chose in your life. Your children you didn't choose, you chose your husband, so you're going to make your life with him. So you have an interest in it going well, especially when the children leave. You want to get along with him. For me, it's prioritaire.
Not all French parents would agree with Virginie's ranking, but in general, the question for French parents isn't whether they'll resume having full romantic lives again, but when.
No ideology can dictate the moment when the parents will feel truly ready to find each other again, says the French psychosociologist Jean Epstein. When conditions permit and when they feel ready, the parents will give the baby his rightful place outside their couple.
American experts do sometimes mention that parents should take time for themselves. In Dr. Spock's Baby and Child Care, which my friend Dietlin hands off to me before leaving Paris, there's a two-paragraph section called Needless Self-Sacrifice and Excessive Preoccupation. It says that today's young parents tend to give up all their freedom and all their former pleasures, not as a matter of practicality, but as a matter of principle. Even when these parents occasionally sneak off by themselves, they feel too guilty to get full enjoyment. The book urges parents to carve out quality time together, but only after making all the necessary sacrifice of time and effort to your children. French experts don't treat having quality time together as an afterthought. They're adamant and unambiguous about it. That's perhaps because they're very sanguine and upfront about how hard babies can be on a marriage. It isn't for nothing that a good number of couples separate in the first few years or the first few months following the arrival of a child. Everything changes, one article says. In the French parenting books I read, le couple is treated as a central and crucial topic. Some French parenting websites occasionally have as many articles on le couple as they do on pregnancy.
The child must not invade the parent's whole universe. For family balance, the parents also need personal space, writes Hélène Delire-Snédière, the pediatrician. The child understands, without a clash and always very young, that his parents need time that's not about work, the house, shopping, children.
Once French parents emerge from the initial cocooning period, they take this call to coupledom seriously. There is actually a time of day in France known as adult time or parent time. It's when the kids go to sleep. Anticipation of adult time helps explain why, once the fairy tales are read and the songs are sung, French parents are strict about enforcing bedtime. They treat adult time not as an occasional hard-won privilege, but as a basic human need. Judith, an art historian with three young kids, explains that all three are asleep by 8 or 8:30 because I need a world for myself. French parents don't just think these separations are good for parents. They also genuinely believe that they're important for kids, who must understand that their parents have their own pleasures. Thus, the child understands that he is not the center of the world, and this is essential for his development, the French parenting guide, Your Child Explains. French parents don't just have their nights to themselves. After Bean starts school, we are confronted with a seemingly endless series of mid-semester two-week holidays. During these times, I can't even arrange a play date. Most of Bean's friends have been dispatched to stay with their grandparents in the countryside or the suburbs. Their parents use this time to work, travel, have sex, and just be alone. Virginie says she takes a 10-day holiday alone with her husband every year. It's non-negotiable. Her kids, ages 4 to 14, stay with Virginie's parents in a village about 2 hours by train from Paris. Virginie says guilt doesn't enter into this holiday. With what you construct between the two of you when you're away for 10 days, it has to be good for the kids too. She says that kids also occasionally need space from their parents. When they all reunite after the trip, it's very sweet. The French parents I meet grab adult time whenever they can. Caroline, the physical therapist, tells me without a trace of guilt that her mother is picking up her 3-year-old son from maternelle on Friday afternoon and looking after him through Sunday. She says that on their weekend off, she and her husband plan to sleep late and go to the movies. French parents even get pockets of adult time when their kids are home. Florence, 42, with 3 kids ages 3 to 6, tells me that on weekend mornings, "The kids don't have the right to enter our room until we open the door." Until then, miraculously, they've learned to play by themselves. Inspired by her story, Simon and I try this. To our amazement, it mostly works, though we have to reteach it to the kids every few weeks. I have trouble explaining the concept of a date night to my French colleagues. For starters, there's no dating in France. Here, when you start going out with someone, it's automatically supposed to be exclusive. In France, a date sounds too tentative and too much like a job interview to be romantic. It's the same once a couple lives together. Date night, with its implied sudden switch from sweatpants to stilettos, sounds contrived to my French friends. They take issue with the implication that real life is unsexy and exhausting, and that they should schedule romance like it's a trip to the dentist. When the American movie Date Night comes to France, it's titled Crazy Night. The couple in the film are supposed to be typical suburban Americans with kids. A reviewer for the Associated Press describes the pair as tired, ordinary, but reasonably content. In an opening scene, they're awakened in the morning when one of their children pounces on their bed. French critics are horrified by such scenes. A reviewer for Le Figaro describes the kids in the film as unbearable. Despite having kids who don't pounce on them in the morning, French women would seem to have more to complain about than American women do. They lag behind Americans in key measures of gender equality, such as the percentage of women in the legislature and heading large corporations. And they have a bigger gap than we do between what men and women earn. French inequality is especially pronounced at home. French women spend 89% more time than men doing household work and looking after children. In the United States, women spend 31% more time than men on household activities and 25% more time on childcare. Despite all this, my American and British girlfriends with kids seem a lot angrier at their husbands and partners than my French girlfriends are. I am fuming that he doesn't bother to be competent about a whole slew of stuff that I ask him to do, my friend Anya writes to me in an email about her husband. He's turned me into a shrewish nag, and once I get mad, it's hard for me to cool back down. American friends, or even acquaintances, regularly pull me aside at dinner parties to grumble about something their husbands have just done. Whole lunches are devoted to such complaints. They're indignant about how, without them, their households would have no clean towels, living plants, or matching socks. Simon gets many points for effort. He gamely takes Bean across town one Saturday to get some American-sized passport photos. But in a typical twist, he returns with photos that make Bean look like a 5-year-old psychopath having a bad hair day. Since the boys were born, Simon's incompetence is less charming. I no longer find it adorably mystifying when he breaks the second hands on all his watches or reads our expensive English-language magazines in the shower. Some mornings, our whole marriage seems to hinge on the fact that he doesn't shake the orange juice before he pours it. For some reason, we mostly fight about food. I put up a "Don't snap at Simon" sign in the kitchen. He leaves his beloved cheeses unwrapped in the refrigerator, where they quickly dry out. When the boys are a bit older, Simon gets a phone call while he's brushing their teeth. I take over, only to discover that Leo still has an entire dried apricot in his mouth. When I complain, Simon says he feels disempowered by my elaborate rules. When I get together with my Anglophone girlfriends, it's just a matter of time before we start venting about such things. At one dinner in Paris, 3 of the 6 women at the table discover, in a ricochet of Me Too's, that their husbands all retreat to the bathroom for a long session just when it's time to put the kids to bed. Their complaining is so intense, I have to remind myself that these are women in solid marriages, and not on the verge of divorce. When I get together with French women of the same social class, this type of complaining doesn't happen. When I ask, French women acknowledge that they sometimes have to prod their husbands to do more around the house. Most say they've had their sulky moments, when it felt like they were carrying the whole household while their husbands were lying on the couch. But somehow in France, this imbalance doesn't lead to what a writer in the best-selling American anthology, The Bitch in the House, calls the awful silent process of tallying up and storing away and keeping tabs on what he helped out with and what he did not. French women are no doubt tired from playing mother, wife, and worker simultaneously, but they don't reflexively blame their husbands for this, or at least not with the venom that American women often do. Possibly French women are just more private, but even the mothers I get to know well don't seem to be secretly boiling over with the belief that the life they have isn't the one they deserve. Their unhappiness seems like normal unhappiness. No matter how much I dig, I don't find rage. Partly this is because French women don't expect men to be their equals. They view men as a separate species, which by nature isn't good at booking babysitters, buying tablecloths, or remembering to schedule checkups with the pediatrician. "I think French women accept more the differences between the sexes," says Deborah Olivier, author of What French Women Know. "I don't think that they expect men to rise to the plate with the same kind of meticulous attention and sense of urgency." When the French women I know mention their partners' inadequacies, it's to laugh about how adorably inept the men are. "They're just not capable. We are superior," jokes Virginie, as her girlfriends chuckle. Another mother breaks into peals of laughter when she describes how her husband blow-dries her daughter's hair without brushing it first, so the little girl goes to school looking like Don King. This outlook creates a virtuous cycle. French women don't harp on men about their shortcomings or mistakes, so the men aren't demoralized. They feel more generous toward their wives, whom they praise for their feats of micromanagement and their command of household details. This praise, instead of the tension and resentment that builds in Anglophone households, seems to make the inequality easier to bear. "My husband says I can't do what you do," another Parisian mom, Camille, proudly tells the group. None of this follows the American feminist script, but it seems to go a lot more smoothly. 50-50 equality just isn't the gold standard for the Parisian women I know. Maybe this will change one day, but for now, the mothers I meet care more about finding a balance that works. Laurence, a management consultant with three kids, has a husband who works long hours during the week. She has switched to part-time. The couple used to fight all weekend about who does what. But lately, Laurence has been urging her husband to go to his Aikido class on Saturday mornings, since he's more relaxed afterward. She'd rather do a bit more childcare in exchange for a husband who's cheerful and calm. French mothers also seem better at giving up some control and lowering their standards in exchange for more free time and less stress. "You just have to say, 'I'm going to come home and there's going to be a week's worth of laundry in a pile,'" Virginie tells me, when I mention that I'm taking Bean to the United States for a week and leaving Simon in Paris with the boys. There are structural reasons why French women seem calmer than American women. They take about 21 more vacation days each year. France has less feminist rhetoric, but it has many more institutions that enable women to work. There's the national paid maternity leave. The United States has none. The subsidized nannies and creches, the free universal preschool from age 3, and myriad tax credits and payments for having kids. All this doesn't ensure that there's equality between men and women, but it does ensure that French women can have both a career and kids. If you drop the forlorn hope of 50-50 equality, it becomes easier to enjoy the fact that some urban French husbands do quite a lot of childcare, cooking, and dishwashing. A 2006 French study found that just 15% of fathers of infants participated equally in the baby's care, and 11% took primary responsibility. But 44% played very active supporting roles, You see these dads, adorably scruffy, pushing strollers to the park on Saturday mornings and bringing home bags of groceries afterward. This latter category of dads often focused on housework and cooking in particular. The French mothers I meet often say their husbands handle specific domains, like homework or cleaning up after dinner. Perhaps having this clear division of labor is the secret. Or maybe French couples are just more fatalistic about marriage.
One of the great feelings of a couple and of marriage is gratitude to the person who hasn't left, says Laurence Ferrari, the anchorwoman of France's top nightly news program. Ferrari, 44, is a pretty blonde who's 6 months pregnant with her second husband's baby. She's speaking to the raffish, professionally provocative French philosopher Pascal Bruckner. The two are discussing love and marriage. Are they a good combination? For a French magazine. Ferrari and Bruckner are part of the French elite, a rarefied circle of journalists, politicians, academics, and business people who socialize with and marry each other. Their views represent an exaggerated, perhaps aspirational version of how ordinary French people think.
Today, mariage no longer has a bourgeois connotation. To the contrary, for me, it's an act of bravado, Ferrari says.
Mariage is a revolutionary adventure, Bruckner replies. Love is an indomitable feeling. The tragedy of love is the fact that it changes, and we are not the masters of this change.
Ferrari concurs.
It's because of that, as I persist in saying, mariage for love is a magnificent risk.
In a sign of how far we've come socially, Simon and I are invited away for the weekend, with kids, to the country home of my French friend Hélène and her husband William. They too have twins and a singleton. Hélène, who's tall, with a heart-shaped face and ethereal blue eyes, grew up in Reims, the capital of the Champagne region. Her family's vacation home is nearby in the Ardennes, close to the Belgian border. Many of World War I's battles took place in the Ardennes. For 4 years, French and German soldiers dug trenches on opposite sides of a narrow stretch of territory called No Man's Land and fired artillery and machine guns at each other. The two sides lived in such close proximity that they knew each other's work shifts and habits, the way neighbors do. Sometimes they'd hold up handwritten signs for the other side to read. In the small town where Hélène's family home is, it feels as if the shelling only recently stopped. People here don't say World War I. They say 14 to 18. Many of the homes and buildings destroyed in the war were never rebuilt, leaving a lot of the landscape covered in fields. Hélène and William are ultra-dedicated parents all day long, but I notice that each night we're there, as soon as the kids are down, they bring out the cigarettes and the wine, turn on the radio, and have what is obviously adult time. They want to profiter, to take advantage of the company and the warm summer night. Hélène is so keen to profiter one afternoon when we're driving with the kids that she pulls over to a field in the late afternoon, whips out a blanket from the trunk, and produces cake for our goûter. The setting is so picture-perfect, it's almost more pleasure than I can handle. On weekends, William gets up early with the kids. One morning, he pops out of the house, while Simon babysits, to fetch some fresh pain au chocolat and a crusty baguette. Hélène eventually wanders downstairs in her pajamas, her hair adorably mussed, and plops down at the breakfast table.
J'adore cette baguette.
I adore this baguette, she says to William, as soon as she sees the bread he's bought. It's a very simple, sweet, honest thing to say, and I can't imagine saying anything like it to Simon. I usually say that he's bought the wrong baguette, or worry that he's left a mess that I'll have to clean up. I tend not to wake up feeling very generous toward him. He doesn't make me beam with delight, at least not first thing in the morning. That sheer girlish pleasure,
j'adore cette baguette,
sadly doesn't exist between us anymore. I tell Simon the baguette story as we're driving home from the Ardennes, past fields of yellow flowers and the occasional stone war memorial.
We need more of that. J'adore cette baguette, he says.
He's right. We absolutely do.